24. A spectacularly good liar. Nicola Gobbo finally faces the commission. 2020. It's 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday, the 4th of February, and Nicola Gobbo is supposed to begin her testimony to the Royal Commission. But there is an unexplained snag. Of course there is. At 9:50 a.m, Commissioner Margaret McMurdo speaks of some delays, but promises a 10 a.m. start. Journalists in the gallery speak of placing bets on whether Gobbo will give evidence or not, then pass the time ruminating on McMurdo's passing resemblance to a younger version of former Governor-General Quentin Bryce. Gobbo is facing what she has long avoided, telling the truth in a public courtroom. But she has gained concessions. With a nod to the absurd, the hearing room will follow Winnicky's lead and stare at an empty chair in the witness box while Gobbo tells her story over the phone. There will be no vision of her testimony, just a disembodied voice, prompting speculations about a new look, perhaps plastic surgery. McMurdo has sensibly adopted a pragmatic line. Something is better than nothing, imposing the usual rules on a witness who is emotionally unstable, or, so says a succession of medical reports, might compel her to refuse to pick up the phone. Gobbo's version of the truth is certain to diverge from the police line presented to the inquiry over many months. The Lawyer X scandal is her story. There is the why, the first question everyone wants to ask, and there is the how. Can Gobbo steer the commission away from suggestions of her own criminal behaviour? Will she rekindle her past powers of hidden influence to cast the blame elsewhere? The most pressing question is answered at 10:02 a.m. Finally, Gobbo is on the other end of the line. Nicola Marie Gobbo. She answers from an unknown location before being sworn in. Gobbo is throaty, and her voice will turn more nasal over coming days. As usual, she sounds measured and calm, in defiance of her drastic behaviours. If she doesn't quite speak roughly, she sounds as though she has addressed many rough people on their own terms. She makes concessions about her breaches of privilege and unethical behaviour. In the face of the damning evidence, how can she not? In retrospect, she says repeatedly, drawing distance between the person she was and the person she now claims to be, she admits that she acted improperly and made choices that potentially broke the law. But she describes this behaviour as if she is speaking of someone else. Her matter-of-factness exacerbates the jolt of her more extraordinary admissions, as if the systemic deception of the justice system equates with the reckless impulses of a speeding driver. What Gobbo says doesn't change everything, but her thoughts lift some cryptic choices into the glare. Winnicky guides her through a chronology that seeks to make sense of the unknowable, and the audience is rewarded with Gobbo's singular logic in describing the illogical. We already know that she accumulated knowledge at the expense of her ethics, that she thrilled to the power of knowing more than anyone else. Yet Gobbo's humiliating tell-all over 5 days is coupled with disclaimers. She will say that she is a victim of police forces bigger than she is. She sounds pitiful and scathing, forgetful and sharp, helpful and recalcitrant, proud and shameful. The clues lie in her unfiltered contradictions. Observers finally get to glimpse the clouded links in her thinking. Gobbo is the keeper of all the secrets, but how many will she share? The commission hears how Gobbo's legal career started with a lie, and how she was breaching her professional ethics as soon as she became a barrister. Australia's greatest ever legal scandal was triggered by a law graduate with self-esteem issues. Winicky ponders the affidavit Gobbo submitted to the Legal Admissions Board in 1997. In it, she omitted crucial facts. Her career could have ended before it began, if she hadn't fashioned a story in conflict with the facts of her 1993 guilty plea to drug use and possession. She didn't mention in her affidavit that her ex-housemate and drug trafficker Brian Wilson co-owned her Carlton property, or that he returned to live with Gobbo 2 years after their house was raided, or that she had used amphetamines herself. She tries to blame her lawyer at the time for her untruthful affidavit. Winicky is sceptical. And Gobbo finally agrees that she misled the Board of Examiners, and that she might have been rejected or faced other repercussions had she set out her true circumstances back then. Point one is that Gobbo's law career was built on willful distortions. Point two is that she was an informer before she was a lawyer. She wasn't a good university student, she says, just one who applied herself under pressure. Study, as later with the law, was cover for other pursuits. Her informing against Wilson in 1995 is critical to the Gobbo narrative. It began, she says, because her ex-housemate wouldn't leave the house. From 1998, she was feeding police information that her employer, Levi Diamond, was laundering money. The police came to her, she says. There was nowhere to turn, a chronic Gobbo problem. She is embarrassed by her poor judgment back then, she says, another recurring theme. She was threatened with being charged for crimes concerning money laundering and attempting to pervert the course of justice if she did not assist officers, and she was too green to recognize the emptiness of the threats. A pattern was set. She met her first unofficial handler after qualifying as a lawyer, Senior Sergeant Wayne Strawhorn, in a South Melbourne coffee shop. She says she was petrified by his perceived power. She says he seemed predatory and manipulative. My then level of maturity and naivete was very different to what it is now, she says. I don't want to labour the point, but the simple point I make is this. You say you were providing, you believe, albeit in a naive way, information to a police officer about matters that you knew of as a result of you being a lawyer and acting for people. Winicky says, how could that possibly be acceptable? Gobbo replies, well, you say matters that I became aware of in the context of acting for someone as a lawyer. Yes, that's correct. But not all those matters that I'm aware of because I'm acting as a lawyer are necessarily privileged. It's a weak defence. As Victoria Police Barrister Saul Holt, QC, later says to Gobbo, of all the defence lawyers in Australia and abroad, none, bar Gobbo, has abandoned their ethics because a police officer invited them to. Strawhorn passed on his chatty coffee companion to Senior Constable Jeff Pope from the Asset Recovery Squad, who to this day denies that he slept with his secret source. Winicky wonders why a newly minted barrister would agree to be handed over to another police handler. Gobbo's reply touches on a critical point in her story. She found saying no very difficult. Gobbo later informed to Inspector Peter DeSanto, who investigated Strawhorn for drug trafficking. Strawhorn was eventually charged and sentenced to 7 years jail. DeSanto was a master manipulator, like Strawhorn, Gobbo says, but more polished of manner. These tales are intended to explain the formative exchanges of a master informer, and they're not terribly satisfying. By Gobbo's account, her career in subterfuge began because she did not know how to stop it. Gobbo also tried to inform to the Australian Federal Police in these early days, and to the National Crime Authority, NCA. She approached these agencies herself. She wanted a double life. She slept with an NCA officer, it emerges, though her memory is patchy. Is he balding with blonde hair? Gobbo asks, prompting involuntary smirks in the hearing room. The genesis of the greatest legal scandal in modern Australia lies in these connections. Gobbo was informing to three different arms of police at the same time as she was being hailed in the Herald Sun as one of Victoria's youngest ever female barristers at 26. She was a full-time barrister from 1998 until 2009, and she was informing, unofficially or not, right throughout those years. After she was deregistered in 2009, she tried to start informing again. Gobbo offers another fresh clue. After completing a master's in law, she hoped in 1998 to do a doctorate paper about the illegality of police informer relationships. "I know it will sound laughable in a sense when I say this now," she comments. Let's put it another way. Gobbo was fascinated by informers when she began informing. She was a spy in search of a master. At the same time, she was forging social as well as professional relationships with organised crime figures who were the clients of her boss, Levi Diamond. It's not funny, in a funny way, but it's very ironic that I'm telling you this in a Royal Commission, she says. Gobbo's parting sentiment on this first day of evidence might be shared by the detectives who exploited a lost soul. She has had a blinding headache for 4 days or more. "If Mr. Winnicky is going to keep going," Gobbo says, "can I take more painkillers, please?" Nicola Gobbo wants to set the record straight. It's day two, and she is more forthright than yesterday. She never stayed at Tony Mockbell's house, she tells the Royal Commission. He never stayed at hers. Nor does she use illicit drugs. As for her reported promiscuity, "my privacy has been invaded comprehensively, but the picture that has been painted of me is far from the truth in many respects," she has written in a slim 7-page statement to the commission. Yet a tawdry hookup epitomises the Gobbo enigma. It will dominate today's evidence because it is an episode with no good answers. Gobbo puts aside her occasional spurts of belligerence in talking about the events of 2003 and 2004. She boasts a sharp memory, despite health issues, and negotiates the pseudonyms of protected identities without hesitation. Yet Gobbo sounds uncertain about her choices leading up to the murders of Terry and Christine Hodson. She agrees with Winnicky that she did not act like a lawyer at the time, that she tried to impress the people around her. It seems she gloried in the power of forbidden knowledge. Gobbo was involved with every stakeholder bar Michelle in the 2003 Dublin Street burglary. This was her perfect storm. She toyed with everyone in her twisted pursuit of power. She played the crooks and the cops and the officers who investigated both. Gobbo presents a sorry study in naivete, as if she were far younger than her 30-something years at that time. Her emotional maturity seemed pathetic. Of course she would do it differently if she had her time again, her mantra goes, in an "if I only knew then what I know now" lament. When Gobbo describes herself as out of my depth amid out-of-control events, Winnicky plucks alternative adjectives out of the air. He calls her behaviour untenable and improper, and Gobbo is too canny to try to argue. Gobbo's entanglement traces to the night of the 2003 AFL Grand Final, when the Dublin Street drug house in Oakley was burgled. She represented the burglars and the burgled. She met her clients in the guise of a lawyer, but she was acting as a police agent. She sent Hodson to Inspector Peter DeSanto and his ethical standards department to snitch on dirty cops. Then she cooked up extra dollops of crazy. Within 2 weeks, she caught up with one of the suspect cops, Paul Dale, for drinks. The pair fell into bed that night. Gobbo made herself the prize in a tug of war between DeSanto and Dale. Winicky, do you believe you acted inappropriately? Gobbo, looking back, there were a lot of things that were at best confused, and at worst, yes, totally inappropriate. Winicky, well, why did you continue to do it? Gobbo, well, I mean, I don't want to come across as making excuses, but where my mind was then was obviously quite different to how I can look at it from this point in my life. Winicky, where was your mind then? I mean, you'd studied law, you'd studied ethics, you knew very well what was ethically right and what was ethically wrong. What's the explanation? Was it the desire to help police? Gobbo, well, it was a combination, I think. It was a desire to help Mr. DeSanto and to, you know, I know it sounds pathetic, but to live up to what his expectations were of me. I was also being pushed in the background by Tony Mockbell, who wanted to find out what, as much as he could, about what police did and didn't know. Dale wanted to know if Tony wanted to kill him because he'd burgled a place that belonged to Tony. So, yeah, it was all, there was, I felt pressure from all around, and you're right, I should have walked away from all of them. Winicky, look, the reality is you weren't operating as a legal practitioner. You weren't operating as a barrister. You were operating as an accumulator of information, either for yourself or for other people. Isn't that the situation? Gobbo, yeah, I can't disagree with that. Gobbo denies a police theory that she passed the blue file detailing Terry Hodson's prodigious history of informing from Dale to Tony Mockbell. She said her burner phone contact with Dale, which ended just before Hodson's death, probably ceased because the phone credit ran out. I want to make it clear that I'm not offering this as a cop-out excuse, Gobbo says, in what sounds like a cop-out excuse. Gobbo seems like she's describing a needy child. She wanted to be the keeper of secrets, but she could not keep them from spilling out. She later fretted, quite rightly, about being implicated of criminality in the lead-up to the Hodson murders. Winicky is spared the need to prove that Gobbo was a willing participant. Instead, he asks whether she knew her behaviour was wrong at the time. She sounds weary, or is she ashamed? Of course I did, she replies. It seems Gobbo's inexplicable choices in 2003 and 2004 triggered her inexplicable role as a secret agent in the years ahead. Over the next 2 days of evidence, she gets a chance to explain. Her testimony relating to the Hodson killings has been underwhelming. Dowsley and Carlyon both think she knows more than she's said. The depths of her fixations remain untapped. Perhaps they will never be understood, but Gobbo does throw up tidbits that have never previously been revealed. They are signposts to her troubled motives and personality. Take her hobby during these 2 years. In her spare time, Gobbo compiled chronologies of drug cases, not for clients, but for personal aggrandizement. She cross-referenced the chronologies, figured out informer identities, and tracked who was top and who was bottom of Melbourne's criminal netherworld. Yet she had already wearied of her lifestyle. She harboured hopes of escaping criminal law, mainly because she felt so used by Tony Mockbell. The paradox, as she herself acknowledges, is that her remarkable choices over these 2 years laid the foundation for her official registration as an informer in 2005. In too deep, Gobbo dived deeper. By January 2004, Gobbo was telling DeSanto everything he asked of her. Soon, she was doing the same with another smooth operator, Detective Sergeant Stuart Bateson of Piranha. After her stroke on the 24th of July 2004, she was scared and stuck, she told Bateson in a teary chat. She believed her position was intractable. Winicky calls her out on the claims. Her hospital recovery was a perfect opportunity to walk away from her deceitful attempts at lawyering. It wasn't that simple, she explains. She had massive property loans. She had no one to turn to for advice. Soon, Bateson was asking Gobbo about her fellow gangland lawyers. Victoria Police had instituted a push against lawyers they suspected of enabling gangland crimes by passing messages between criminals and accepting the proceeds of crime as fees. Bateson and Gobbo met for coffees, sometimes at South Melbourne's Emerald Hotel. Gobbo volunteered supposedly damning details against another lawyer, known as Solicitor 2, under Royal Commission suppressions. The irony is that Gobbo herself was guilty of the same enabling. When Solicitor 2 was charged with providing false evidence to the Australian Crime Commission, that solicitor asked Gobbo to defend the charges in court. Gobbo accepted, even though she was informing on her client to Bateson, who had a specific level of hatred for Solicitor 2. Do you accept that the concept of a barrister appearing for a person in relation to whom they are providing information about to the police is repugnant? Winicky asks. Yes, Gobbo replies, again citing weak and pathetic self-esteem issues. For the record, Solicitor 2 tells Dowsley and Carlyon that Gobbo's representation was poor. In court, Gobbo meekly agreed with the prosecutor's position against her client. These choices reek of the righteous zeal of a dibba-dobba. Gobbo does claim a moral code. In her evidence, she speaks of being disgusted by specific examples of both police and criminal behaviour. But morals alone do not explain her snitching on other lawyers. Gobbo speaks about her thinking in the lead-up to being registered as an informer in September 2005. She was being asked to betray her client, Mockbell henchman Mr. Beautiful, and she felt she could not go on. Gobbo needed an out. So she decided to become a police agent. She talks of this era as if it were a lifetime ago. She appreciates now that her handlers and her controller Sandy White played to her ego after they frightened her into submission. She calls the pitch of White and subordinate handler Peter Smith a bad cop, worse bad cop routine. White and Smith said they would know if she lied to them before inviting her to tell them everything about her client Tony Mockbell. They later told Gobbo she was on top of the ladder of all-time greatest Victorian informers. In hindsight, it was to obviously boost my self-esteem and to make me feel more important about what I was doing, and, you know, my type A personality was making me do more, she says. A little later she adds, it was insane and idiotic and wrong on so many levels, and what then transpired was just more craziness. Winicky pulls her up. Her graduation to official informing was a natural progression, he suggests. She had escape routes and chose not to take them. Gobbo concedes the point with a contradiction. She was famed for excoriating witnesses in a courtroom, but chose to become an informer out of a desire not to disappoint anyone. My emotional functioning, my maturity, my stupidity, my mistakes, I can't back away from any of that. And my wanting to please everyone, inability to say no, I couldn't see the wood for the trees, she says. I mean, for me to have thought that was a sensible thing to do shows that what you've just suggested, the kind of rational, logical, easy solution, was not apparent. The police encouraged her to get closer to her first target, a drug dealer who they hoped would implicate the Mockbells. Winicky asks a question that may hold serious ramifications for Gobbo, as well as the senior detectives involved. When the target was arrested, she was warned to ignore her handlers on seeing them at the police station. And you were aware that by turning up and providing advice to the drug dealer, you were in effect doing things which would have a tendency to pervert the course of justice? Potentially, Gobbo replies. She shared with investigators her mental dossiers of her clients' quirks and weak points. De facto psychological profiles were a signature extra during her years of informing. Gobbo represented the suspects she helped apprehend, then advised police on breaking them down. Her relationship with her handlers came to resemble a toxic affair. First, the deep satisfaction and the thrill of forbidden pursuits. Then the side effects, the ill health and anxiety. As Gobbo puts it, detectives compromised their ethics to protect the secret. They were good men, tethered to a dreadful choice. Yes, Gobbo agrees 14 years later, the ethics of it were all wrong. Winicky mentions details untold until now. He has the financial records that show the fees Gobbo charged her clients. She helped police to charge Farouk Orman with murder, and he spent 12 years in jail before his conviction was overturned in 2019 because of Gobbo's conflicted role. Gobbo charged Orman $32,000. She charged Rob Karam about $60,000 while she was informing against him as 3838. She charged Tony Mockbell $1,800 for legal assistance after his 2007 capture in Athens, at the same time as she was briefing police about his attempts to avoid extradition. Tony's sister-in-law, Zaharula Mockbell, was billed about $4,000. Gobbo told investigators about the deficiencies in the fraud case against her. Gobbo charged Carl Williams at least $1,650 and his father George $14,000. Gobbo told Bateson in late June 2005 that George Williams had taken out a dodgy property loan to pay legal fees, perhaps those he owed Gobbo. Put simply, her clients paid Gobbo money to help put them in jail. Was this a criminal conspiracy to defraud criminals? In her view, though, her informer role meant she had to charge them money. If she did not, they would wonder why. That word, repugnant, again comes to mind. Gobbo cannot remember many of the details Winicky is recounting, but she is candid enough. Yes, I think I've already said the entire ethics of all this were wrong. Winicky describes the deceit in harsher terms. He suggests the fees are evidence that she committed the crime of financial advantage by deception. Gobbo counters that her handlers knew, obviously wrongly, but I was led to believe that they were the police and anything that I was doing that was wrong, they would stop me, she says. The issue festered. By July 2007, according to her tally, she had incriminated 20 people while acting as their lawyer. Winicky returns to the question of crimes. Do you accept that that was wrong? That the people who you had represented should have known, and they should have known that you were not providing them with independent legal advice? He asks. And every time it did occur, there was the potential for that case, for those proceedings to be perverted. Or to be overturned, yes, Gobbo replies. Gobbo's house was searched by the Royal Commission sometime after December 2018. There, in scattered envelopes marked fees, lay bundles of cash. In a box marked evidence was $5,000 in an envelope labelled Car Wash, July Rent. Gobbo's co-ownership of an Avondale Heights car wash, where gangland criminals chattered under the spray of water, appears to have been lucrative. I wish I had piles of $100 notes sitting in a box in my garage, whispers a journalist in the gallery. There was $2,000 held by rubber bands inside a birthday card signed from Carl and Piranha. Gobbo says she knows nothing about it, nor the other wads of cash. Did she make so much money out of the people she betrayed, and later the police she said betrayed her, that she could overlook $13,000 lying about her house? Nicola Gobbo, the police agent, did not have to incriminate Rob Karam in 2007. She welcomed men like him into her orbit because she wanted to continue to inform after she'd destroyed the Mockbell Enterprise from within. The move to wind down Gobbo's informer use was first touted in May 2006, after Milad Mockbell was arrested. The following year, police talked of no longer tasking their secret informer with intelligence gathering. Then they tasked her with intelligence gathering. Gobbo went to extraordinary lengths, with the encouragement of police, to try to jail Karam. What we thought was going to be confined to the Mockbells, for example, just snowballed in a massive way. And then all of a sudden there were people telling me about murders, bashing and abduction, labs, pill presses and drug importations, she says. It was just what I thought was going to finish in a certain period of time, just went on and on and on. Her handlers doubled as counsellors, assisting with her poor mental health and anxieties. Records from the time show they invited her to stop informing whenever she liked. She admits that she did not want to disappoint Sandy White, and she claims he wanted to get Karam. So the relationship continued. She told her handlers about the thrill of her informer calling. In her evidence, she seeks to write off her childlike remarks, at the time, as good-natured banter. But there is a recurring sameness to them. Gobbo hungered for new targets and fresh intrigues, even though informing was bad for her health. She didn't, or couldn't, stop. In 2011, 2 years after she was deregistered as 3838, and a year after she received a promise that police would leave her alone, Gobbo offered police fresh information about new crimes. At the end, as at the beginning, she wanted to be a spy. A succession of police liaison officers was rotated to attend to Gobbo's needs. But in 2011, the police didn't want to hear from their best-ever source anymore. As she put it, Gobbo was treated as a kind of problem. As police QC Saul Holt asks, "Ms. Gobbo, far from wanting to get on with your life, every time you have an opportunity, you're trying to contact police officers and trying to give them the very information you were for years at the SDU." The affair had long since soured and threatened to spill over into public view. Gobbo had kept her life, if not her health, and she had millions of dollars to start again. But the evidence suggests she had an inveterate need to keep going, like a boxer too punch drunk to know that he should hang up the gloves. Would it be fair to say, Miss Gobbo, that you were an extremely enthusiastic informer? Asks Jeff Chettle, QC, representing the police handlers at the Royal Commission. "I think that, yes, I think that's my personality," she replies. "I either do something 150% or don't do it at all." Jeff Gleason, QC, represents former Chief Commissioner Simon Overland. He asks about keeping the truth from her loved ones and lying on her application to become a lawyer. Gleason poses the headline question that encapsulates her secret career in informing. "See, what I want to put to you, Ms. Gobbo, is that you are a spectacularly good liar. Do you accept that?" Yes. "And do you accept that you've lied so well and so often that you've lost the capacity to know when you're telling a lie?" "No, I don't." "When did you give up your practice of being a spectacularly good liar, Ms. Gobbo?" "Perhaps 2010 or 2011, she says. The label sticks. It is put to her that she is lying about her lying. Gobbo appeared to mislead the court in her evidence at the secret Supreme Court trial in front of Justice Timothy Ginnane in 2017. She told that court that she did not know the contents of Shifty the Supergrass's 2004 statements against his fellow criminals at the time she was representing him. She is likewise unconvincing in her Royal Commission denials that she burgled the office of legal colleague Sharon Cure in 2007. Gobbo says it is rubbish that she examined Cure's confidential papers. Yet she told her handlers at the time she had been looking around Cure's chambers. Holt points out apparent discrepancies regarding Gobbo's place in the Briars investigation into the 2003 killing of Shane Charteris Abbott. She gave a statement to detectives Steve Waddell and Rod Iddles in 2009. Later, the unsigned document said the chief murder suspect, Mark Perry, had confessed the killing to her. Gobbo denies to the Royal Commission that she had told investigators about a confession by Perry. Then Holt produces a text message written by Gobbo to a police officer after a newspaper report into the Briars investigation was published in late October 2009. Good to see that Vic Pohl have finally broken the story on Mark Perry, the murderer I told Briars all about. Read today's paper so you're up to speed. How fucking funny is it to be so instrumental, yet treated with at least indifference? Circus. Holt asks Gobbo if she told investigators about the supposed confession. It looks like it, Gobbo says. She has changed her mind. No one knows where the truth lies. It begs the question, does Gobbo simply say whatever she thinks the listener wants to hear? She is quizzed over her claim that she never lied to her handlers. She told them the truth, perhaps, but not the whole truth. For example, she didn't mention her use of burner phones to contact Paul Dale in the months before the Hodson killings in 2004. Gobbo does not impress when she is presented with letters written in 2011 by her then lawyer, Levi Diamond, to the Director of Public Prosecutions. He was sounding out a reward on her behalf for her giving evidence about the Hodson killings. What sort of person wants a prize for playing games that end in murder? After fighting so long to avoid giving evidence, Gobbo appears to be enjoying her questioning. As embarrassing as the process is, she seems buoyed by the attention. If she cannot remember, she sounds genuinely apologetic. But in her own words, she is a liar, a professional liar. The recurring charge gores her in questions about the aftermath of Dowsley's 2014 story in the Herald Sun. In a meeting with senior police, she asserted that she did not think she had acted improperly. Yet, as she concedes in her evidence, Gobbo and her handlers knew that they were breaking the rules from the moment her informing began. They hid it as well as they could, lest the behaviour be judged in a particular way. When Winicky re-examines Gobbo, he almost snarls. The good bloke persona has shifted to attack dog. He feels that Gobbo has twisted her testimony, as if seeking to agree with each of her questioners as they cross-examine her. Ms. Gobbo, you said in your evidence, and I think you said it on a number of occasions, that you don't want to give anyone the wrong impression. Do you recall saying that? Yes. Can I suggest to you, on a number of occasions during the course of your evidence, that is in fact what you have done. Do you accept that? Not necessarily intentionally, but if I have, I have. In her final minutes after 5 days of evidence, in transcripts that run to 222,000 words, Gobbo concedes that she cannot recall an actual sexual encounter with Pope. She provides no where or when, just an insistence that she knows it to be true. I can't think of a reason why I would make it up, she says. You have to wonder, Is Gobbo still the spectacularly good liar she once was? There is no goodbye at the end of Gobbo's evidence, not even a thank you. Commission staff seek to squeeze other witnesses into the 45 minutes left in the day. Gobbo is off the line and back in the wind. Her version of events has reshaped dozens of details. The police were driving the bus. They never said stop. She has scoffed at senior Piranha detectives who have claimed in evidence that they knew little about her informing. Stuart Bateson, Gavin Ryan, and Jim O'Brien are fingered by name for their knowledge and application of unseemly practices. Winicky gets Gobbo to agree that only a judge could determine the legality of the Gobbo conspiracy, and no judge was ever consulted. Under unbearable pressures, Gobbo did what she was good at, acquiring information as power to be dispensed at her discretion. She was used by the crooks, and she was used by Victoria Police, and she in turn burned the crooks and Victoria Police alike. The police line diverges from the Gobbo line, but they share a disingenuous theme. Each party blames the other. If there is something to see here, it isn't their fault. Noble cause is a prevailing posture in the Royal Commission witness box. The right intent and the wrong execution. But many police officers have not raised their hands and accepted responsibility. The bosses blame the rank and file. The rank and file blame the bosses. Victoria Police needed to solve crimes, and they threw every available weapon at the cause. This is the accepted line. If perjury and other crimes were an unfortunate consequence, they should be treated like regrettable side effects. Many police officers have been less than forthcoming. They have hunkered in the shadows, as if hoping the light will not penetrate to the damning details. There is a collective cravenness in this approach. Willful myopia and a resistance to transparency still seem to thrive at Victoria Police. Simon Overland was only one officer of many recalled to the witness box because fresh evidence, often delayed by the tardy processes of Victoria Police document production, required renewed examination. The overarching conclusion is that Gobbo couldn't say no, and neither could Victoria Police. One thing led to a lot of other things, she says. The Royal Commission is now furnished with much of the how, when, where, and who. It has identified 96 current prisoners who may have historical claims against Gobbo's behaviour. Among the 1,296 people who may have suffered for receiving her legal advice. In 137 years of the Victorian Bar, no other lawyer has treated the courts with such contempt. Yet the Gobbo enigma has survived the process largely intact. Who is she? Why did she do it? We may never really know.